Welcome to Conversations with Evie and Elizabeth by Empower Survivors. This is a recording from our online meetings program happening every Monday evening at 6 p.m. Central Time. Each week, we will introduce conversation starters and discuss issues of interest for survivors of childhood sexual abuse and trauma. Evie and Elizabeth help you feel relaxed and supported in this interactive group that meets weekly to discuss issues pertaining to healing, wellness, mental health, and more. If you want to participate in a live meeting, engage in the conversation, or find some support, register online at empowersurvivors.net for our next live Zoom meeting. Privacy of all participants is a priority for us, so only our guest talk is being recorded for this podcast. Join us from the comfort of your own home as we introduce special guests and topics that are sure to be of interest. This is Elizabeth. I am the CEO and founder of Empower Survivors, a nonprofit organization of survivors helping survivors of childhood sexual abuse, providing safe spaces of healing. Visit our website and join the community at empowersurvivors.net. We don't have to do this alone. We believe you, we see you, we hear you, and we are here for you now.
Okay, so I don't know how much you know about the brain, but one of the things the typical clients that I am seeing are those who have been in therapy for a number of years, 10, 15, 25 years, and are not getting well. And so also what I'm finding is that the therapists that they've been seeing just had them in talk therapy. And they're not really explaining too much to their clients about how the brain functions and what happens to it when we have a traumatic event. So I thought I would just spend a few minutes tonight talking about what we call the triune brain. And the scientist, which I am not, we know that the brain is a very complex organ with many, many, many parts. And so what the scientists have done to organize it so that those of us who are non-scientists can better understand it, they were referring to it as the triune brain. So we're just going to kind of look at the three main parts of the brain. And I want to say that the PowerPoint will be available to you in these handouts will be as well. So we're going to start with the reptilian brain, which is the brain stem. This is what we have in common with reptiles. This is the first part of the brain that's going to be developed in utero. And this is where our fight and flight reside. So this part of the brain is responsible for survival and maintenance. Core functions are regulating our heartbeat, breathing, and other vital organs. The basic need is for safety and avoiding harm. When our need is met here, we feel at peace. And when the need is not met, we experience fear. The second part of the brain that is then developed is called the mammalian brain, or what we call the midbrain. It's a subcortical region. It's associated with mammalian evolution. We might think of it as the little mouse part of the brain, responsible for our feelings and our memory formation. This is where the hippocampus is. It is where our short and long-term memory are stored. If you have anyone or know anyone who is affected by Alzheimer's, it's the hippocampus. That's the part of the brain that is probably affected the most. And this is also the reason when we have complex trauma that's repeated over and over and over again, and survivors, you know, aren't able to recall the events. I mean, this is the part of the brain that is most affected. The basic need is satisfaction and approaching rewards. When the need is met, we feel contentment. When the need is not met, we experience frustration. Then the last part of the brain to be developed, and also I want to say the brain is the only organ in the body that is not fully developed at birth. As you know, researchers are saying it can be age 25 and some closer to 30 before the prefrontal cortex is completely formed in us. So the cortex is a larger and more sophisticated than the other two layers. Thus, we think this part of the brain to primate in human evolution. It's responsible for our higher mental functions. The core functions are regulating attention, our feelings and desires, our complex reasoning, abstract thoughts, our imagination, our language and empathy. The basic need is connection and attachment to others. When the need is met, we feel love. When the need is not met, we experience heartache. So what happens in the brain when we experience a traumatic event? And I also want to say that in mental health, for probably the past decade, we have been distancing ourselves from focusing on the event. We're not saying, we're not dismissing the event, but a lot of the events are mostly crimes. And in mental health, we don't treat crimes. But what we're more concerned with is how the traumatic event is impacting the brain in the entire human being. Because another thing, you know, we know that we're going to hold our trauma in our bodies. So when we see a potential threat, like we see this lion here, what's interesting is part of the retina is located by the brainstem where this fight and flight resides. So what happens, we see a potential threat and this prefrontal cortex that we have kind of goes offline, so to speak. And the reason is because this prefrontal cortex moves too slowly. If we would have to, it's all about reason and logic. And if we have to sit here and try and to debate if we are actually in danger, it could be too late. So it kind of goes offline. We're not thinking clearly. We're mostly acting in this midbrain area where our emotions are and the brainstem. And we're going to try and assess, can we get away? That's the very first thing we're going to do. And if we can, we will. So if the predator moves closer, this pterodactyl gray area ignites a flight and fight response. There we go. Okay. So if we're not able to get away, then the body goes into a freeze response. And it's really important to understand that this is not a choice. Our bodies are designed to do this. And this is one of the things that will keep us safe. So many survivors often think that because they froze, their bodies betrayed them. Or people will say, well, you didn't get away, you didn't run, you didn't, you know, so you obviously wanted to stay, you obviously liked it or whatever. And we know that that's not true. We become frozen if we honestly feel we cannot escape. And we see this in nature all the time. If you've read, if you're familiar with Peter Levine and all of his work with the body, I remember he was showing a video of I think it was a lion or a tiger going after like a gazelle. And the gazelle was with a herd, but got kind of stranded or separated from it. So it's going after this gazelle and the gazelle can't get away. So what it did, it just fell on its back, went into rigor mortis immediately. The heart rate dropped so low that it almost became dead. And the tiger goes up around it, sniffs it, but sees, he thinks that it's dead. He doesn't want it. And a lot of times in nature, if killing the animal is what's important, because if they feel that it's already dead, then it could be diseased meat or whatever. So killing the animal is a part of part of nature. So anyway, the you see the lion or the tiger flauntering off, and at some point the tiger is still in the view of the frame, but this gazelle realizes it's no longer in danger. It just starts shaking, immediately flips upright and scampers off. So similar things are happening again in our own bodies. And the important thing to remember here, it is never, ever a cognitive choice when our bodies go into this freeze mode. If the predator doesn't move away, the person may shut down completely. So our heart rate will drop, our respiratory rate drops, some people stop breathing, muscles become limp, metabolism shuts down, endorphins are released. The person enters a state of no pain. They are no longer aware of their surroundings. So during inescapable trauma, this is a very adaptive way for the brain and the body to respond. And again, if this has happened to you, particularly, you know, as a child or in them, you know, you're not going to be able to remember the details. And if, you know, law enforcement, a lot of people will come against survivors and say, well, you know, if you can't remember, then it didn't really happen, and a lot of that other stuff. But now we know the truth. Okay, so there is a triphasic model of trauma recovery. We clearly follow it at Restoration. Most of the clients I have, I've never heard of it. It's been around for decades. And I make it clear to all of my clients, this is a standard of care, you know, that we follow. So the first is always safety and stabilization. We always, 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 always want to make sure that the client is stable before we start to ask them to process a trauma memory. And for me, I always tell my clients, I will never, ever ask you to tell me the details of what happened to you. It's completely up to you what you want to tell me, when you want to tell me, but I don't need the details to bring healing to you. And a lot of people are kind of shocked by that, but it's really true. You know, and the majority of my clients have been violated within their families, and they know that I'm a mandated reporter, and they're not ready to report. So they don't have to tell me those details, but they can still receive a lot of healing. So what we're doing in the safety and stabilization phase is that I'm teaching the client to regulate themselves. So trauma, when it impacts the brain, causes this brain that we saw with this triune brain, when everything is working the way it's supposed to, is what we call an integrated brain. But when trauma happens, the prefrontal cortex kind of goes offline. And so what's mostly impacted are these two subcortical layers of the brain. And if trauma isn't worked through, then the person is in the next trauma comes, they're just kind of like stuck in this midbrain area where the amygdala, the emotions, all of that. And so we just teach them to regulate themselves. It's probably the longest and probably one of the hardest phases of trauma recovery. It's can be just kind of like a roller coaster. I mean, clients are constantly quitting, they're coming back and saying this is hard. And so basically what we're doing is we are teaching the client to grow neural pathways where sometimes no neural pathways have been existing. And that's really exciting. The second phase is processing of traumatic memories. I would, you know, a lot of my clients, because we've done such a good job of safety and stabilization, they're no longer having any nightmares. When they do get triggered, it's not that kind of big of a deal. They can manage it because they've learned to regulate themselves. Many clients, if not the majority of clients, if they really do a good job of safety and stabilization, they just don't have any interest of processing the traumatic memories. And then the last phase is post-traumatic growth. It's like, okay, now I've had all this healing. Who am I? What can I do? And where do I go from here? So here's kind of an example, another handout of how trauma impacts the brain. And so it doesn't pull apart like this, but basically it's just kind of showing that it's no longer an integrated brain. It's no longer functioning the way that it's supposed to. So as therapists, we can help the client integrate their brain in one of two ways. We can start at the top and work down, or we can start at the bottom and work up. Now, for most clients who have experienced a lot of complex trauma, again, this prefrontal cortex isn't working very well. So it doesn't make any sense to start there and to do a top-down approach. I start with what we call bottom-up approaches, and that is a DBT. It's so the language of this midbrain, we have to realize that words don't reside in the midbrain. They only reside in the left prefrontal cortex of our brain. That's the only place that words reside in our entire body. So when someone is stuck in this midbrain, a lot of times, if someone has asked you to explain something and maybe you don't have any words for it, it's because the words just aren't there. And again, this prefrontal cortex isn't functioning the way that it needs to. So the language of this midbrain is going to be these expressive therapies. It's going to be art. It's going to be movement, drama, music. That's the language of the midbrain. And so when we use those expressions, what I'm finding, it just kind of somehow pushes up into this prefrontal cortex, and then the survivor can put words to it. So here's an example. I was working with a client. I was the secondary therapist. She had a primary therapist that she was seeing every week. He was not doing a very good job of stabilizing her. He was only attempting to do so verbally. Wasn't working very well. So he sent her to me. I'm certified in dialectical behavior therapy, but I still find that it's too cognitive for my clients. So I bring in a lot of the art. So anyway, she'd been with me, I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks, seemed to be doing fairly well. She comes in that day and she says, I don't want to do any art. I just need to talk. I said, okay, fine. I did have all the art supplies out there for her to use. Everything was going along fine until I asked her a very specific question and she opened up her mouth to speak and no words came out. I could see the frustration on her face. And I just sat there and waited, and she tried again and no words came out. So I asked her if she wanted to draw out her response. She just immediately picked up the paper, and it was like 11 by 14. So it's a decent size of paper. she picked up a marker and she just started drawing. And within like 2 minutes, she had filled that paper just with the line drawings. And then she just flipped it around and said, just started talking about it. I didn't even ask. So it was really interesting to watch how, you know, again, doing that expressive therapy just loosed her tongue. I've seen it over and over and over and over and over again. Another thing that I find is that my clients will often tell me one thing verbally, but when they do their artwork, it really shows something else. And so that's another way to bring up probably some pretty difficult topics, but the client is the one that did the artwork. So, you know, I'm just there to talk to them about what they did. We do a lot of the artwork is particularly at the beginning, I start with distress tolerance skills, and then we go into mindfulness. And through mindfulness, I teach it in a couple of ways. I teach it through visual art, I teach it through the body, and I teach it through self-compassion. And then we get into emotion regulation, which again, bring in a lot of art, and then interpersonal communication. That is that whole first phase of trauma recovery. I'm also certified in EMDR, or not certified, but I'm trained in levels 1 and 2. But you know, I find out that I don't need it very much. My clients don't need it. Or if they do need it, it's just 1 or 2 sessions. And it's simply because they've been stabilized really well. I often would have clients come in and say, they've done all this research and they just want like 8, you know, sessions of EMDR. My response is trauma or therapy really isn't something that we pick off of a menu. I am not going to do EMDR with any client unless I know that they're stabilized, because what we're doing is we're bringing up that traumatic memory. And also it's important to know, and I think that EMDR is a wonderful tool, and I'm certainly glad we have it. I'm glad I'm trained in it, but it does not erase the memory. It just changes the relationship that the client has with the memory, and it doesn't teach the client to regulate themselves. So the majority of my clients that have been in therapy for all these years, the therapists that they've been seeing have not stabilized them, and they've just jumped in to trauma recovery work. So they'll come to me and they don't have any PTSD, but their anxiety is off the charts, so is their depression, and they don't know how to regulate themselves. And that's it. So any questions that you may have, I'll do my best to answer them.
First of all, I have to say that was a great presentation. I really like the slides, and it helps me better understand things. I really loved your explanation. And I remember seeing the Peter Levine video where the gazelle goes off, shakes it all off. And so that's why I've talked to survivors in the past about how some of them just never, you know, all that gets trapped in the body because it never got, you know, that was never able to happen. So I remember that video well. That was a real eye-opener for me.
I have a quick question. Okay. Did I cut you off, Elizabeth? Thank you. That was so interesting. I have a quick question about the artwork, which so as you do your artwork and, you know, you go through your trauma and you're healing and healing and healing, your artwork might change. And then I mean, I So then should's a not a great word, but what is your opinion as a survivor grows and changes and heals and becomes more stabilized? Is it something that perhaps you, as a survivor, you don't need to revisit that old artwork to see where you were and where you've gotten? Or, you know, is it just like, you know, just like as you're talking and as you heal, you don't really go back and go, oh yeah, I remember when I was so like, well, or you might, I don't know. But I am curious about the artwork because, you know, just me, for instance, I can just speak for myself. My artwork from when I was first starting to where I was like 6 or 7 years later was completely different. And I've never gone back to look at the beginning artwork, but I also haven't gotten rid of it. So I was wondering, you know, is there kind of a school of thought about that? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, it completes sense. And a lot of therapists have completely different opinions. I've heard where some therapists say you never ever allow the client to keep their artwork until they terminate. To me, I would never do that. So I encourage my clients to always tell them at the beginning, you're gonna be doing a lot of artwork, think about how you wanna file it. Some put them in folders. I had one client who went out and bought a fairly large and fancy portfolio. And she even brought it in. She showed me everything that, you know, she had. So when we do art, I have worksheets for them. So where everything's laid out and it will tell the art materials. It's going to say we're going to have a getting started. It's going to ask a couple of questions. Then you're going to do the art experience. Then you're going to do the reflection, written reflections. And it's really important that they write out their answers because that's when we're doing, that way we're integrating the right and left hemispheres of the brain. So we're not only midbrain, push it up, but then we need to integrate right and left hemispheres. Often I will tell them, go back and look and pull up these other, that activity, blah, blah, blah. Maybe we need to redo that again. I want them to be able to access these things and redo them as different things come up, you know, in their lives. So I highly encourage that.
I would have to say, I can remember when I first started the healing journey, I didn't have the words. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to say it. I didn't even know. I couldn't get my head around it. And I know for me, drawing ended up being a big thing. And I can remember almost being embarrassed of what I was drawing at the time because it was, you know, I thought, boy, if anybody sees this, they're going to think I'm just insane. But it ended up being really helpful for me. I mean, it was really, really dark. It was showing abuse and feelings and, you know, dark colors and rage and these types of things. And for me, I know, and you reminded me of this tonight, of just how important it was. It was a way that helped me. And then the therapist would look at the artwork, have the discussion with me and say, wow, I noticed this in your picture here. This person's very large and you're really tiny. What were the feelings there? So we talk about it a little bit. And then, you know, I really felt like that helped a lot. And for me, I did keep the artwork. And I put it in a spot where I knew people wouldn't have access to it. But I also found it helpful to be able to look back and see where I was and where I am now, and to see how the art transformed from incredibly dark and ugly and vile to, you know, almost more of a self-acceptance and love and gratitude. It was just, for me, it was really neat to be able to go back and look.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I also have, you know, clients will say, well, I'm not artistic and, you know, I'm kind of afraid of art and that sort of thing. And I always reassure them, we're not painting a Picasso that's going to go on the wall. We're sticking with line, shape, and color. And we also do a lot of, every time when they come in, we are working with different art materials because they really want to keep their variety and keep their interest up. So we do a lot of collage work and sometimes we work with clay. And I have one client, he was an engineer. And so everything he did was a three-dimensional. He did these structures. I mean, every time. It took him forever to get, we'd go like two or three sessions to get what we should have been done maybe in an hour. But it's about him making meaning of something for himself. And so, and he really kind of got into it. So it's, we just want the client to be able to make meaning. It needs to be meaningful for them, whatever that may be.
I'm glad you brought that up because it doesn't have to be drawing. For me, I did a tremendous amount of clay. Model magic, you know, I did a lot of dioramas and things like that. I did lots of art, but I needed that, like you were talking about that other client, I needed that three-dimensional, and I just would create all these scenes, you know. So yeah, it's, I'm glad you brought it up that art can be so many things. And, you know, we have lots of artists who join us every week. We have, you know, we have an accomplished musician on here too. So, So I don't know if, do we have questions in chat, Elizabeth?
Yeah, we actually did. And one of the members asked, what if you're not good at art? And I think it's important to know that you don't have to be. I know for me, I couldn't draw. I only did stick figures at the beginning and it morphed into other things. And so you don't have to be. Sometimes it's a matter of using different colors. And, you know, black. I used a lot of black for rage or, you know, I mean, all kinds of different things. So I don't think you have to be good at art. Somebody also asked, what do you think about body work? I had a lot of success with myofascial release therapy, but I came to healing by way of chronic pain since I hadn't remembered my trauma. I think, what do you think of that, Candace?
Oh, yes, a huge yes. And so what we, I don't know if you're aware or not, but we have these two major nerves on both sides of our body. If you're familiar with Stephen Porges' work, the polyvagal theory, and that they're called the vagus nerves. They kind of look like, if you would slice them open, they kind of look like maybe fiber optic cable. They go from the brainstem to all of our organs, okay? So if you want to think about these nerves, these two nerves, they're really kind of like information highways. They're sending information from the brain to the body and the body to the brain constantly all day long. So the majority, 80% of the information of the traffic on these two nerves is from the body to the brain. That means only 20% of the information is going from the brain to the body. We're always going to feel our emotions in our body before we know them in our head. And all that stuff happens in nanoseconds, you know. But I think it's a really exciting time, you know, to be a therapist. Like I said, when I teach mindfulness, I teach it through the visual art, I teach it through the body, and teach it through self-compassion, which again is a lot of body work. And I've had some training from Pat Ogden. If you're familiar with her, she does, it's a sensorimotor psychotherapy. And what I'm also finding is that so often my clients, particularly the younger, when their trauma occurred, they really struggle to make this mind-body connection. So I have one client, she was violated when she was an infant, not sexually, but just, you know, some violations by her parents. And what we know, if you look at developmental trauma, what we know is because the brain is constantly under development, right, for 25 years, so when trauma happens to a child, that part of the brain that's under development at that time, that's going to be the most impacted. And this young woman, she's in her early 30s, and she cannot read social cues. It's really, really, really challenging for her. Unfortunately, she has a court order against her because she was stalking someone that she wanted to be friends with. I mean, that just goes to show that she just wasn't picking up on if somebody's smiling at her or not, or you know, those kinds of things. And she holds down her job, but she's had a lot of issues and been, you know, put on leave and a lot of those things simply because she can't understand the social cues, you know, at her job. So she's been with me for 2.5 years and she's making a lot of progress, but she's still, it's almost like the mind and the body are disconnected. And so I'm starting to bring in, I have a teaching artist, a movement teaching artist. Her background is in dance, but she's also done some training with trauma sensitive movements and that sort of thing. So we work together, the three of us will work together. And I've done this with her with several clients, and it seems to work really well. And just to help her, it would be great if she could even just take a dance class or something like that, but her insurance won't pay for anything like that, and she doesn't have any. So the way we're getting around it, I'm just bringing the movement artist into our session, and the movement artist will mostly be the one working with her, but I will be there so we can kind of, you know, take care of it that way. But I would say also I have more inquiries for Megan, who is not licensed, the movement therapist, than I do for psychotherapy. Often people will actually call and want her by name. Is Megan available? So
I think that's wonderful that you do that and you work with all these different modalities. Do you think a lot of that too, somebody had a question here too, but do you think a lot of that is just learning boundaries too? Because a lot of us struggle with knowing what healthy boundaries are too.
Definitely. It's all there. And we go slow. I mean, I go with the pace of the client, you know, whatever that is. And then I also run some groups. I mean, pre-COVID, I ran a Tuesday night art transforming trauma group, and it's because a lot of therapists don't do groups, they don't do art in working with, but it was a way for them to come in and to get some of that, you know. So an interesting thing too, I would find these clients that weren't mine that would come, they would do their artwork and then they would take it to their therapist during the week, would unpack it a little bit more. They would tell me that, yeah, I took that, and I'm like, there's a blah, 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 and that's what I'm doing with my artwork every week, and I said, okay.
Oh, I love that. One of the members asked, how many clients do you have that are mentally challenged?
Right now, I would say I just have the one that has kind of a lower IQ, and here's the interesting thing about her. It seemed like I was, you know, kind of picking up on some autistic characteristics with her. She had never been diagnosed with anything like that. And so because of this court order, I was able to send her to a psychologist and the court paid for her to be tested, because I just needed to know if I was on the right track for therapy and all that. So after 2 days of testing, he called me and he said, "I want you to know that this is a courtesy call and I never do this. I never call the treating therapist, and I just give the test results to the client and they can give it to whoever they want." And he said, "In 20 years of testing, she has been the most complicated and confusing client I have ever seen, and I have no definitive answers for you." Well, my heart just went to my toes. And I thought, my gosh, can I help her? Who do I refer to her to? That sort of thing. And he asked me how I diagnosed her with, of course, with a lot of PTSD, want to know how I was treating her. And he said, "You're spot on." And he said, "I do see a lot of autistic characteristics, but my hunch is she really isn't autistic. It's all the trauma. And once this trauma gets cleared up, the autistic features are going to go away." And so, you know, so often we're just throwing out labels, especially the non-professionals, oh, you're ADHD, or you're this, or you're that, you know, and particularly where people are in their trauma, they can manifest a whole lot of things that maybe just aren't particularly true. I have a client who just finished graduate school, and the mother seems to think that he's bipolar. And I said, "Well, I think graduate school makes everybody manic. So I'm not really sure that, you know, that he is."
I've heard that from other therapists too, that say, you know, we can put this label, that label, and this label. And sometimes it's really beneficial because it can help us understand our symptoms or maybe how we've lived the most of our life. But really it's unprocessed trauma that needs to be released and that sort of thing. And so I know a lot of people, you know, can get stuck on certain things like that. Like you said, the different, you know, being diagnosed with all these different things. Somebody asked the question, can you make recommendations to a client's social services people? I'm not sure I understand the question, but.
Okay, so a lot of my clients, particularly this one I've been telling you about, he is on a type of Medicaid, and she really does need social service support. I mean, she's living in an apartment by herself, and she doesn't know how to advocate for herself, you know, and really encouraging her. She met another client through the ART Tuesday night group, and they got to be friends. And so the other client knows how to advocate for herself, and she's really helping her do that. But a lot of them, they need the extra accountability, and they just need the help, you know, and trying to navigate government websites and everything else is it's just difficult. So yeah, that's, and also sometimes we work with some anti-trafficking organizations, and other, we work with a foster care agency. They will, you know, send their clients, you know, to us. So we just always want to make sure that they have good support system around them. And I will say this, I have known people with complex trauma to get well without therapy. I've never known anyone to get well without a healthy support system. And so that's really, and I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. I never went to therapy. And there are many, you know, reasons for that, but I healed in community, you know, with others. So it's really, really important that you can get that support around you so that you can heal.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Candace, because That was really nice to share that. Also, I have to say, you know, like a lot of times when I'm talking to survivors, I'll say not everybody heals the same. You know, some of us maybe, you know, we needed a couple different therapists and then group mm-hmm. support, and other ones, like you said, it's about having a community where you can actually get in and, you know, have that support. I think so often as survivors, we don't have that good support system, and to be able to identify who's going to be part of that support team and really have them there to process and grow, I think is great.
I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
What is trauma-sensitive movement?
Okay, so Megan, there are actually courses you can take in trauma-sensitive movement. And so some of it might be a little bit more like yoga-based, but not exactly. And so an example might be if you're working with particularly people who have been detained, you never want to do any movements where they're putting their hands behind their back, because a lot of times they're handcuffed behind their back and those kinds of things. And you just go really, really slow. A lot of with our movement, we're not up moving around the room. We're just sitting in a chair or just standing. So we're just doing, paying attention to the body, put it that way. A lot of, if you've ever done body scans, a lot of that kind of work is often incorporated, you know, into trauma-sensitive movement. I remember the first time that Megan worked with me, we had a client who, she was in her 50s, and she had a primary therapist, and so she's coming to me for more, some body movement and things. She felt kind of stuck and she felt some tension, but she didn't exactly know what that was all about, and her therapist didn't do that kind of work. So it turns out that this client had been trafficked as a child by her father, and she didn't know it till she came to me. When she just told me a little bit of her story, I said, "Do you realize you've been trafficked?" She goes, "No, I wasn't." And I said, "Well, not an attorney, but according to my understanding of the law, blah, 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 happened. That is a trafficking situation." And so, and that's happened several times with me with older women in particular, that they were trafficked. So anyway, bring Megan in to work with this woman. And the client kept saying, "You're going too fast. You need to slow down." And so after the session, Megan and I would have these debriefs. And Megan, she would say, "I knew it was going to be slow," but she said, "This is like inchworm." And I said, I know. I said, "We only go at the pace of the client." And so it's really opened up Megan's eyes to the, you know, the depth of the trauma. And she's, you know, continuing to educate herself. I keep planting seeds in her brain that she needs to go back and get her clinical degree, because she would be absolutely awesome, because people are already asking for her, you know. But so that is kind of what trauma-sensitive movement would be about. Just very, very slow moves, and also being aware of the client the best you can, their situation, what they're in, or something maybe that they, you know, has happened to them.
I was wondering, for somebody who has maybe never heard of EMDR, could you explain a little bit of that, what it is?
Sure. So basically, it's bilateral movement. I mean, that's kind of what it is in a nutshell. So it's right, left, right, left. And I remember I was watching a Netflix series on Bill's brain, which is Bill Gates's brain, and is wife at the time made the comment, she said, "You know, Bill does his best processing when he goes out for a walk. And I thought, well, of course he does. It's bilateral. It's walking right, left, right, left. So that's what it is bringing up the traumatic memory. And then you're integrating the right and left hemispheres of the brain. That's what you're doing. But I teach some of my clients are really fearful of it. And so one of the ways you get them used to it is I install bilateral tapping or even any kind of movement that's positive first, because we always want to get the positive. What you're doing is you're getting it into the nervous system. So you can just tap right, left, right, left, right, left on yourself like this. Bring up something that's positive. So we know that trauma involves at least one of the five senses. So we need to heal through the five senses. So we bring up these positive, what we call resources, and then we go through all five senses. What do you see? What do you hear? What do you touch? What do you smell? What do you taste? What do you feel? And then when you have that image, tap it into your nervous system like that. So rocking is also it's bilateral. You can tap your toes. You can tap your heels. One day because I live in DC and the traffic is always horrendous, and I realized I was tapping on my steering wheel while I was driving. Oh my gosh, I'm tapping. I'm calming myself down because traffic is so bad here. But because a lot of my clients say, if you're at a meeting and they're feeling themselves getting a little triggered or anxiety or something, they're not going to sit here and do this, but they can, if they're sitting, they can tap their toes, right, left, or heels. There are a variety of ways that you can, do that. So there's a great book out by Laurel Parnell, and it's called Tapping In. She is, she does a lot of EMDR, and this is where I learned, do all this installation before. And so, just say that you are you're kind of like stuck, I will always ask my clients, what resource do you need to help you through a situation? And your resources can be real or imagined. They just have to be meaningful for you. Bring up that image, go through all five senses, tap it in. A lot of people, survivors, have been through the exercise, what they would call safe place or peaceful place. Oftentimes they will draw all that out. But I take it the next step and say, okay, after you've drawn it out, you've given me a visual, whether you're drawing it out, you've found collage work, close your eyes, see yourself in that position, in that place, bring up all five senses, and then tap it into your nervous system. I had a little girl, she was about 14, she had been trafficked, and she's at detention center. And she said the only way that she could get to sleep at night was to tap in her foster mother, which you call grandma. So it's just, it's soothing, it's calming, and men like it just as much as women do.
Well, go ahead, Elizabeth. I was just gonna piggyback and ask, would you say, for writing on the computer, that's is bilateral stimulation.
I hadn't really thought about it, but it would be. Right, left, right, left.
Yeah.
But if you're doing a lot of on this hand and then this hand, usually it's right, left, right, left.
Okay.
And years ago, I had a young woman, she was a social worker, and she would, she was working with one of our traffic girls, and she made the comment to me. She said, we seem to have the best conversations when we go out on a run together. And of course, it was before we knew a lot of, you know, all this stuff. But yeah, again, it was bilateral. So that the girl was opening up a little bit more. She felt safer doing that.
You know, I noticed that even the difference between, I know this is a little bit different, but between my son and my daughters can sit and talk about a certain situation, but my son would do better by going out to the basketball hoop, playing basketball and having a conversation. Mm-hmm. That's going to, you know, it's easier to have the discussions, and it's just, it's interesting how all this works. It's amazing.
You know, we have to let our survivors for ourselves and others know that there's really no right or wrong. It just needs to be meaningful for you. That's all.
We have quite a bit of time left. Does anybody have any questions or comments? You know, you can ask in person, or else, like I said, you can put it in the chat. I know somebody just mentioned drumming has tons of right left patterns in it. Drums aren't my instrument of specialty, but it has a tons of right and left patterns.
Yeah. Robin raised her hand.
Go ahead, Robin.
Thank you. Hi, Candace. I feel like I haven't had my head right here today. So I was going to claim ADHD, but maybe that's not true after something you said earlier. Look, I'm in Australia, and what I'm curious about is, like, I have some healing background and I have a degree, but in terms of actually working in the arena of trauma, I sit here and I research, what else do I need to learn? What else do I need to be certified in? But what I'm really wanting to do is actually to create community, to work in a group where people come together of their own accord, because they're not like in crisis. Like, I don't want to sit there and counsel people crying. I want them to come together to get some education around something, get some hands-on experience of just some little method or self-healing technique and all that sort of stuff. And I'm, because I'm so far away, I know things could be different, but they're also similar. What sorts of ways can I begin this type of work without needing to go and get another 6 qualifications when I feel like I'm smart enough in some ways to do this? So what sort of resources do I really need? And how would you suggest somebody who's like at this precipice now would go about doing this?
Well, I'm sure you probably have to have a lot of continuing education. So like for here in the US, I get a lot of my training through PESI, and they're it's just PESI, and they have, you know, a lot of online training. So I get almost everything is online training, you know, today. We have to have so many continuing education units to keep our license. So there's those, and there's also NICABM, which is NICABM, which stands for the National Institute of Clinical Practitioners. I can't remember what all it stands for, but just if you NICABM and you Google that, they have tons of Their training is excellent, and it has all these handouts that I did for the slide, all that is from them. So there's a lot of self-study, you know, that you can do.
I've heard both of those, Robin, and those are really good. They're great resources.
Yeah, I've actually bought some training from them and some other places, but beyond licensing and being licensed, because I don't know that I am, because I'm not a psychologist. So what do you have awareness of groups that form in the community that have got educated people in health, but not necessarily as a psychologist. Can you offer anything in that regard, or is it sort of a no-go zone?
I'm not aware of anything, because in the US, we have different kinds of licenses. Social workers have to be licensed, professional counselors like myself are licensed. And groups and stuff are extremely challenging to find. I run a lot of them, well, pre-COVID. I haven't run anything at all since post-COVID. I was hoping to start to do some things after Labor Day, but the numbers here in DC are really high, so we're not gonna do anything until the numbers get, to safer place. But we have food, just do some simple things. I mean, even when I do mostly visual art, I'm always bringing in the body as well, and a little bit of music. At one point, I had a music therapist, with me too, and it was really interesting to see the way she worked. It's very different. So literally, you can do the safe place or peaceful place through visual art. You can do it through movement, and you can do it through music. It's really whatever. It's really interesting to see how all those different modalities work. And if there is anything, I would encourage you just to start something and see who comes.
Thank you.
This is what I was going to say, and if I may, to respond to that, where I live, there is, in the U.S., there is a, I think it's a mental health association, MHA, and they have peer support groups, which are run by anybody who wants to. You don't have to have any kind of certification. I attended a sexual assault recovery group for a little while, which includes assaults that happened as adults, and I asked if there was anything for victims of childhood sexual abuse specifically, and there wasn't. And she's like, but you could start one, and anyone can, like, just it was pretty unstructured, and I have also found online lots of helpful organizations that kind of give you like a blueprint of how you could, even like literature and stuff, like how they run their meetings, and you could start one of their meeting type things, because they have all the script of how to run it. So, you don't have to have any certifications. That's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Yeah, a good friend of mine, she's one of my volunteers, and so she runs a women's trauma group through her church, and they often go through books. They do kind of a book study, and that's what speaks to those women in there. So I've also known where women come together and bring their handcrafts, or bring their knitting, bring their art, and or whatever it is they want to work on as a way of being together and sharing. Baking. I mean, you can find all kinds of things, right, to bring people together. Gardening. Just find something and that interests you and get started.
Robin, have you ever considered anything like women's prison ministry, where they actually have programs? I think they're usually churches, I think, support them. I belong to a church in Alaska, and I was too scared to go into the prison, but today I wouldn't be afraid. I actually went to a men's prison a couple years ago in a group session, and it was very healing for me just to go in and hear their stories and why they were there, and their hopefulness that once they got out, that they would be able to survive. And there was one young man who just absolutely touched my heart who sat next to me. And he was trans. And he kept saying, I will be paperless in September. And I didn't quite understand what that meant. But what it meant was he spent almost his entire life in prison. Mm-hmm. And he said he was not afraid of the outside world. He was afraid of himself being in the outside mm-hmm. world. So I found that to be a tremendous experience. And because I tend to flit around a lot, I am not... the Zoom is very helpful because I can join anywhere that I'm in the country. So I don't know if you'd consider that, looking into that. I don't know what Australia is like in terms of their ministries for prisoners, but I'm pretty sure they would need some help.
Yeah, at the moment I'm mapping the landscape because I'm in a new state, so I'm investigating things. It's more about, you know, there are a lot of people, maybe it's an old adage because for years people said, oh, what are your qualifications and, you know, what are you certified to do in this and that? And despite, like, I've got so many certifications, it's ridiculous, but they're not now specific in trauma. So as I'm mapping the landscape, I think, yeah, at least, you know, there's been some really valuable feedback on my question. And I think that's part of it, like the prison system here. I think there's, you know, there's work going there. So it's all about, you know, taking another step, just anticipating what can happen when you go and set up a group and things like that. That's important for me as well. So maybe a little bit more trust in myself as well. Thank you for all your comments. Yeah.
Well, I would really encourage you, if whatever it is you do, is to find some accountability. That's because when we work with traumatized people, we're going to absorb that. And you just need to know that it's coming, and you need to be able to go to somebody and to be honest with what you're experiencing and listen to their counsel to kind of guide you. What I see here in the DC area, there have been a lot of churches that have had huge hearts and they've wanted to offer something to, particularly to their own members. But often what I've had some of those women come to my groups and they said that they have felt violated, you know, by them simply because the person leading didn't know much about trauma themselves, and it just ended up causing more harm than good. And so, and I think that's another reason that a lot of churches have just kind of stayed away from it, because they've tried to get into it and it's going to be messy. And so know that when you get into it, but make sure you've got some really good accountability that you can go to. So when these things come up, you can get some wise counsel of how to help. I wasn't a therapist when I first started. We just went because those opportunities were available to us. The door opened, we went. But I also realized while I was there that nobody really understood their mental health. And that just put me on a trajectory to want to learn more. And I want to be the best I can for those I'm called to serve. So I'm constantly learning. It never stops. It just doesn't.
Can I just want to jump in if I could? Empower Survivors is exactly that organization. You know, we are here. I think Elizabeth for sure jump in with the exact amount, because it's been a while since I know, but our closed groups, many of them have thousands and thousands of members who not only, I mean, the common denominator may be childhood sexual abuse, but as we talk about that is just the common denominator. And there's so many other things. And as we've seen time and time again, we have so many people who bring so much, and we have so many people who are looking for extra things. And you know, Elizabeth and I can only offer so much because we're just two people, and we are always looking and open to people who would like to run some groups. And you know, both Elizabeth and I are certified peer support specialists. So that training is out there, and it's free if you live in Minnesota. The Minnesota Department of Health pays for it. I don't know if they pay for it in other places, but we're very open to people running programs. I know Elizabeth posts that a lot. We try to tell people that. And now in the world of Zoom, it doesn't matter where you live. You know, we can reach people everywhere. So if you have an idea, if you'd like to run a program, we're so anxious to expand Empower Survivors and empower survivors all around the world. So you guys here and the people you know, there is a built-in, very stable and successful organization right here at your fingertips. So I just wanted to plug that so that, you know, you guys don't have to, the word that's running, like, you don't have to spin your wheels for that. All you have to do is contact me. My email's on Empower Survivors website. You can contact Elizabeth and she'll forward it to me. And then just so you know, we're very open and we're very excited to all kinds of different healing modalities. So I just wanted to plug that. And I know, Brad, you have had your hand up. So,
you know, I'd like to add real quick too. It's important that no matter what you start, I think Candace was kind of mentioning this, that you're in a position too, where if you're triggered by someone or this, you know how to regulate yourself as well. I know when I started this, because I was in the thick of some things, you know, my therapists were like, you know, great idea, but the first one you need to help is yourself. And then you branch off from that. You get the education, you do this and that. But there's a lot to be offered in the peer support realm. And, you know, here at Empower Survivors, you know, we are a peer run initiative, but we also consult with other therapists and we make sure that we're always staying in our lane because we're not therapists. We're people that have experienced childhood trauma, sexual abuse, have learned from that, have educated ourselves, have gone through some certification. But it's important we stay in our lane and not go over into a different section that we're not knowledgeable in and be vulnerable and transparent and not act like we know things that we don't. And I think that is hugely important because otherwise that's when sometimes this stuff can actually end up being harming to individuals, is when you have somebody who's coming in and being trying to give the perception that they know certain things that they don't. And in that case, that's really, really dangerous. And, but I don't think you necessarily have to have, I mean, there's wounded healers. And when people can do it right, I think you don't have to have, and this is just my personal opinion, but I don't think you necessarily have to have 40 million letters after your name, or, you know, there's things to be offered. And of course we want professionals because there's, you know, they're professionals for a reason. But I always tell people, don't underestimate what you have inside of yourself, the knowledge that you have and the good that you have that then can help another human being. Because there's many wounded healers out here. And sorry, Brad, let's get to you here. I know we only have a couple minutes left here, so I'll close my mouth. And Brad, it's all yours.
Sure, yeah. So the point Candace was making about the role of faith and religion, that really resonated with me, and I think lots of us as well. I think you know, we value spirituality and faith and religion, but I think in my own experience, I feel like the therapists who almost have like a neutral perspective to faith and religion sometimes have been the most beneficial, at least that's been in my case. And I guess what I'm wondering is, I'm not sure how to phrase this exactly, but I guess, how do you differentiate between like the role that religion plays in helping survivors? Because it can be helpful, but it can also be detrimental in some situations too. And I remember you guys had a guest speaker on as maybe a few months ago that made some really good points, I thought. And I guess when it comes to my own support system, I've had some people that they think that the solution is just to like memorize a Bible verse, mm-hmm. and no disrespect to that, but I guess that's what I'm thinking about right now, because faith is important to me, but I think there's other aspects to healing that come into play too. And that's what I'm wondering about more.
Great question. And I mean, I'm a born again Christian, and what's important, because it's really that you see the looks on the faces when I talk to like churches and supporters, you know, who maybe have never had therapy before. But because a lot of times I think what I'm going to be doing, because I'm a Christian, is like cramming a lot of scripture down their throats. And I said, no, I don't. I said, on a standard intake, no matter if you're in detention, if you're at the psych hospital, whatever, a standard intake is always going to ask, are there any religious or cultural traditions that you want to have implemented in your treatment process? And so the client has that opportunity to ask for that. And I always tell my clients, it's up to them how they want it implemented, if they want it implemented or not. So some clients they want prayer at the beginning, at the end, or whatever. And next time they come in, they may not want anything. They may say, you know what? My relationship with the Lord is just kind of like on the table right now, and that's just kind of where it is. And I just really want to focus on the science. And I have, as a therapist, I have to respect that for them. And so, but there are a lot of my clients are coming in simply because they've been to a therapist that didn't know how to integrate their faith, you know, into that. But I just want to say, I talk to my clients about it, and I want to know what's meaningful for them, because it's not about me. And so, and then I will always do my best to implement it for them. And for some, they give me permission to speak with their priest or their pastor, that sort of thing. And so we're working together, you know, because I want to make sure that's part of their support system. So it's, you know, it just differs for each and every person.
I belong to a group in Alaska, an organization. It was called Priceless, and they were going in to help get the prostitutes out of being prostituted. They would never go in with a Bible or any such thing, because that's one of the hardest, most heartbreaking things that can happen. One young woman had grown up in a satanic cult, and they reversed what Jesus looked like and what the devil looked like. So the church was the devil, and they were the saviors. So I think it's very important that even if you may belong to a religious organization, you can even get training through them, which is where I started to do training to go into the prison system. And I think it's really important. The church I belonged to was a church with no walls, so everyone was welcome. And there were some times that people came out of prison. I remember one time where a guy came, they had him work there, and he eventually stole from them, but they held no judgment against him. So I think those are the things that we have to keep in our heart, that whoever we're working with, that we are not going to be in judgment of them. And I totally agree with the shield. You have to shield yourself, because as empaths, we take on so much of what they carry. So I learned that once I was right before I started writing my book and started telling my story, I learned that I always heard a story back, and I learned to not take their story on. So that's a great question, Brad.
I hate to jump in, but it's 7:29 and we are, we need to finish. We need to wrap up, because we end at 7:30. Thank you, Brad. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, everybody who was here tonight. Thank you, Candace. That was, oh man, that was so interesting, and just, it was just so much good information, and you gave that, all that information to us in a very gentle, understandable way. And so thank you so much for that. It was just this, it was very enlightening, and I know it can be very scary when all of a sudden we start talking about brain and, you know, it's like, oh no, I'm not going to understand it, but you made everything really digestible, and we appreciate you so much. We appreciate everybody who came tonight and joined us. We are so grateful for all of you. And with that, remember Thursday nights is the peer support meeting that Elizabeth runs from 6 to 7:30. And then we'll see you next Monday. And wherever you are in the world, have a beautiful, wonderful week. And thank you so much for coming.
We have one last plug. If you're not familiar with Oprah's newest book, What Happened to You? Just a couple of months ago. It is wonderful. It's written in conversation style. So it's just very, very easy to read. Not a whole lot of psychobabble in it. What Happened to You? Conversations on Trauma, Resilience, and Healing. It's her with Bruce Perry, who is a psychiatrist. I'm doing a book review with this with my church in the fall. So get a copy. I think you'll enjoy it. So again, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Candace.
Okay. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to Conversations with Evie and Elizabeth by Empower Survivors, a nonprofit organization of survivors helping survivors, providing safe spaces of healing. It is an honor to have you here and be a part of your healing journey. Join us for one of our next online meetings on Mondays and support groups on Thursdays. For more information about our programs, visit empowersurvivors.net. We don't have to do this alone. We believe you, we see you, we hear you, and we are here for you now.